You have been the one who has put together magicians working at the presidential inaugurals.
Oh, I no, that's actually not accurate. No, I okay, well, disabuse you of that notice. I had nothing to do with organizing any magic at presidential inaugurals.
Okay, you just happen to be part of it.
No, but I can tell you that story if that's interesting to you. I mean, I don't know how many hours we have to do this.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. It was through another podcast that allowed me to recently reconnect with an old friend, Eric Henning. He was to be interviewed by Chris Shepard on SuccessfulPerformerCast.com about his work as the, quote, financial wizard. Eric had been also talking with Ken Kelly and Julian Mather from MagicianBusiness.com that prompted him to listen to a podcast I recorded with them about trade shows. So, Eric reached out to me and we picked up where we left off, never missing a beat. But there was so much to catch up on, plus lots of interesting stories that made me feel like we were leaping from one lily pad to another. As Eric says in this podcast, talking with him is like getting a drink from a fire hydrant. He is an ever-flowing font of interesting stories. I just like hearing his radio voice also. As a full-time professional magician living in the great state of Maryland, just outside our nation's capital of Washington, D.C., he has a lot of stories about the intersection of politics and magic. He's worked for many influential political leaders up through and including more than one sitting president. I caught up with Eric one morning via Skype as we both enjoyed a cup of coffee in our respective homes. After we began chatting for a while, I decided not to break the flow, but to just turn on the recorder and allow you to jump in and listen as if you had just joined us at the coffee shop. My point of contacting Eric for this podcast was to discuss taxes and finances as it directly impacts us as magicians. Well, that was the intent. Instead, we have a delightful conversation on everything but finances. Perhaps we'll pick that up at some future date. My intent with The Magic Word is not to tread the paths that other podcasters have made, but to offer quality, unique content featuring chats with magician friends and learning more about them, and hopefully, along the way, what made them successful. This way, you, the listener, can get to know these magicians on a more personal level rather than their superficial, celebrated status that they may enjoy. In this first of a two-part podcast with Eric, he tells us an interesting story of his long-term speaking engagement in Barbados that was meant to offset propaganda that Fidel Castro was spreading there at the time. He also talks about his work at a presidential inaugural banquet and how he got that gig. These stories and more are straight ahead here on The Magic Word.
Theater study tour in England, or when I was in the investment business, I was researching a book and doing, you know, England and France and Germany. I was performing, doing street magic in France and Switzerland after I graduated from college. And then later on, I was sent on a diplomatic mission by the U.S. government to very dangerous and inconvenient place of Barbados. That was a rough assignment, yeah. I tell you. But it was interesting. It was interesting from a public speaking standpoint. It was interesting because I had to follow Fidel Castro.
As a speaker?
I mean, basically, the week before I got, this is 1994, this is 20 years ago. The week before I arrived, the United Nations had their conference in Barbados on small island sustainable development. And the joke, of course, in the international development community is that the UN solution for small island sustainable development is to hold a conference on every single tropical island. But the point is that that was the last time that Fidel Castro was seen outside of Cuba. Hmm. It was the last time he spoke. And I arrived the following week to try to do media and, you know, some damage control and be kind of the voice of capitalism. And the United States government certified me at that point. This was for USIA, U.S. Information Agency, which doesn't exist anymore. But the USIA guy in there was basically the de facto press secretary for the ambassador. I was sent in on a mission 10 days to come in and do damage control and kind of speak. And the government certified me as an expert speaker in small business development and capital formation. And I did my thing.
Wow. How'd you get in that list?
Because the guy who was the press secretary was a client, an investment client of mine. And a fellow Christian. And he had an interesting story. His name is Tyrone Kemp. He had been the public information officer for the Egyptian, the ambassador to Egypt, who was assassinated in his presence. He was. This wow. is the one where they had the motorcade and they shot up the motorcade, and the
You say that like that's a unique thing. I mean, that seems to happen frequently, as far as
no, not to our ambassadors.
Well, not to ours. Yeah, that was.
It's only recently, but they shot up the motorcade, and it was funny because Tyrone is black, and he was driving his own car. He was driving the lead car, and because he was black and he was driving the car, they thought he was a chauffeur, so they didn't open fire until the second car.
Hmm.
And then the next assignment, his wife is a doctor who worked for the State Department. So they would, she does exams because the State Department personnel overseas have to have a full medical exam once a year. So she would travel around. So they both have red passports. So this, which is important because the next assignment was going to be, the next, to get to the next assignment, they had to fly through Athens.
Mm-hmm.
And they were booked on the plane that got hijacked, where the hijackers took everybody's passport and shot all the Americans. But at the last minute, they missed the plane, and they changed flights.
Hmm.
So they escaped that. Their next assignment was Moscow.
Wow.
Yeah, and so after
that,
put
him in increasing levels of danger.
So he was ready to retire. He was basically on his last assignment for about 3 years. He was getting ready to retire. So they said, you know what? You've had it rough. Let's give you an easy one. So they took him and sent him to Barbados, and Barbados is important strategically because Barbados is the Casablanca of the Western Hemisphere. It is a hotbed of spy activity because it has no written constitution. There's a highly literate English-speaking population, but the government is kind of alternates between capitalists and socialists, and every time there's a new government, all the projects that were given to the cronies of the previous government people are seized by the state and turned over to new cronies. And it's just a very interesting thing. And we had come in, and the year before, the People's Republic of China had donated $25 million sports complex as a gift to the people of the Barbados.
To try to sway them over to communism?
Hoping to sway the next elections, yeah. Mm-hmm. And Barbados, because of its position as the most leeward of the Caribbean islands, it's just barely over. It's right over Venezuela. It's right on the equator. I mean, very, you don't go outside, without a ton of sunscreen. Because of its position, it is strategic. It's a great listening post for everything from South America to Cuba and everything else. And it's also a place where a lot of companies test and governments test out technology. It's been in the forefront of communications technology ever since they started using semaphore flags on the hilltops.
And still is to this day.
Schools out. And still is to this day. That was the place. In 1994, the cabbies had pagers they could talk into, which nobody had ever seen before. So all the stuff that you would see in the States has been done for the previous 2 years, tested in Barbados. Because it's a perfect place for it. It's sitting, it's only the size of about the size of the city of Baltimore. It's a small island.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so and I have some interesting stories about that, but that's neither here nor there. So, yeah, so I've done, someday I'm going to write my autobiography, and nobody's going to believe it because it's just so ridiculous.
You mean with spy stuff like this?
With, yeah, just, author, diplomat, magician, street performer, nobody who does that. But I've been just very lucky and blessed in my life to have these different opportunities. And Tyrone's idea was he brought me in, and during the daytime I'm working for the government and I'm doing, talking at lunch, Rotary lunches and doing TV and radio interviews and being out in the public eye. And then at night I was doing my financial seminars in the churches.
Mm-hmm.
And doing that teaching. And that was really, that was kind of his hidden agenda, was he'd seen my seminar. He said, I want to get you out to the churches in Barbados. Let me see if we can figure out a cover for that.
Now, were you using the churches, as you say, kind of as a cover, I guess, so that way that it was?
No, the government activity was a cover. He really wanted me in the churches, but I could only do that at night when I was not on the government's dime.
But the people who came out were general citizens. It wasn't something necessarily for that particular congregation.
It was both. It was both. I mean, first of all, a guy coming from the United States is an event. They assumed I was a celebrity. So because they were treating me like a celebrity, so they assumed
I was a celebrity.
And I came out there. Well, to them, I was.
Yeah.
And I came out there, and some people came to see me. Mm-hmm. And there's only, quarter million people on the entire island. It's not that huge.
Right.
So if I did a church seminar every night, I probably talked to 4,000 or 5,000 people during the week, and then the word spreads. So, and I actually did a training for some of the pastors there too. So, yeah, it was pretty interesting. It was a lot of interesting economic lessons. That's a whole podcast by itself.
Well, I started recording because I think there's some interesting stuff that you've said over there. So,
well, the thing that was interesting about this is the economy. You know, Britain outlawed slavery in 1832, and the symbol for Barbados on the national flag is a broken trident, which symbolizes the breaking of slavery. But there's still sort of a plantation mentality there. And by that, here's what I mean. I encountered this. It's very interesting. I was getting ready to leave. Betsy and I were getting ready to leave. And the Barbadian dollar, the Bajan dollar, is tied to the U.S. dollar. It's pegged to the U.S. dollar. So there's no currency fluctuation whatsoever. There's no risk in exchanging currency. So I went to the local bank because I had too much local currency. I needed to convert it back into dollars before I came home to the States. And so I'm standing in line, and ahead of me is an African-American gentleman who's obviously a well-dressed businessman. From his accent, he's clearly from New Jersey. And he's ready to go back, and he's doing exactly the same thing. He's got too much Bajan money. He wants to change it to U.S. dollars. And they grilled him for like 20 minutes. So where are you from? Where are you going? What are you doing here? What's your business? Blah, blah, blah. Now, you got to understand, there is no risk in this transaction to the bank. They're just exchanging.
It's dollar for dollar. Yeah.
Well, it's not dollar for dollar, but it's a fixed rate.
Okay.
And so it's just there's a risk. This is like making change.
Yeah.
Okay. There's really no risk at all.
But it was because he was black.
And they're just grilling him. I get up to the line. He finally gets through it all, and he's disgusted. He leaves. I get up to the front of the line, and they see me, and I'm doing exactly a very similar transaction, similar amounts of money. Okay.
Yeah.
And it was, oh, right away, sir. We'll get it done fast. No questions. Would you like a cup of coffee? I'm sorry you have to wait 30 seconds for this.
Wow.
But because I'm white and he's black. Now, this is interesting. Every single person in that bank that was on the staff, including the manager, was also black. So they had internalized that whole sort of oppressive system. And that's there. And there's this mentality of, we can't do it. I remember I was invited to a dinner party, and one of the habits in civilized cultures at the end of dinner is the host proposes a question for people to discuss. And at this point, at this party, the question was, why is it this guy who was very wealthy, plastic surgeon, wanted to invest in some cherry orchards? Now, the Bajan cherry is the only fruit that's known that does not lose vitamin C when you cook it. So Bajan cherry juice is highly prized as a vitamin C source, but almost all of the Bajan cherry juice is grown in Jamaica, not in where it comes from, in Barbados. So, and why is that? Well, the cherry trees take about 7 years to mature. You plant them, but you don't see any fruit. You don't see any return on your investment for 7 years.
Okay.
And the average person would rather go work and get a paycheck at the beer factory, the Red Stripe beer factory, or the Mount Gay rum distillery.
I've been there.
And just because they get the money in their hand now, the mentality is pay me now rather than I can own the business and actually be independent if I'm willing to wait. There's the mentalities. I got to have it now. You know, why is that? There's no entrepreneurial sense. In America, we have this subculture. The reason that you have Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak starting Apple Computer in their garage is because Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard had done the same thing 10 years earlier, and Orville and Wilbur Wright had done the same thing 60 years before that, you see? So there's this sort of idea that if you have an idea and you just work hard enough, you have one good idea and you really pursue it to its end, you can be a millionaire. And that's just this idea in America that we have. It's infused in the culture. And it's not like that everywhere in the world. That's an interesting economic reality. I fear that we are losing that idea in this culture. I'm worried about that.
You know, you live in the D.C. area, Washington, D.C. area. Did you naturally gravitate towards that because of your interest in finances?
No. Or? Well, I grew up here. Grew up here. My parents were both military officers. They were both in the Navy, and they met in California at Point Magoo, and I was born out in California. And and it was interesting because my dad was a widower. His wife had died when his son, my half-brother, was 4 years old. And so when he and my mom got married, there was a minor child in the house. And under the current regulations back in the 50s, that meant that my mom was instantly cashiered. They forced her to resign her commission. They don't do that now. Now they just send them into combat or whatever. But the point is, back then they would cashier the woman because there was a child in the house. So she had to resign, and she stayed at home, became a stay-at-home mom. And my dad, who was in military intelligence, he was actually one of the first people in the world to get a master's degree in nuclear physics. So he became the top expert on the Soviet space program for the Pentagon, and then ended up at Fort Meade at NSA. So I grew up in Maryland in the D.C. area because that's where my dad ended up in his Navy career. And then he retired and stayed on and worked for different defense contractors and basically helped end the Cold War, and that's a whole other story on that.
Is that kind of how that you got into the politics side of it? Yeah. I mean, I know, for an example, that you have been the one who has put together, you know, magicians working at the presidential inaugurals.
Oh, No, that's actually not accurate. No, I disabuse you of that notice. I had nothing to do with organizing any magic at presidential inaugurals. That's
okay, you just happen to be part of it.
No, but I can tell you that story if that's interesting to you. I mean, I don't know how many hours we have to do this. But let me tell you, the reason I was able to do this diplomatic mission is because this guy was my client, and he was working for the government, and he said, I like your financial seminars. They're easy to understand. Let's bring that in as a public service because we want to get this kind of awareness of capitalism and saving money and starting businesses into Barbados. That's something we can, as America, we're kind of the symbol of prosperity and economic empowerment and that sort of thing. That was the angle. So that's really the angle there. No, I got into doing presidential inaugurals because I was nice to Mark D'Souza.
Well, he's easy to be nice to.
He's easy to be nice to. Mark D'Souza, for people who don't know, Mark, get his videos, spend time with him. He is one of the most giving, generous people. Basically, he is almost single-handedly responsible for keeping magic alive in the Philadelphia area, especially after Jack Channon's shop closed. Mm-hmm. And he hosts...
lectures at his home.
Yeah, he has a home theater. He has an actual theater built inside his home where he hosts lectures.
Theater
anyway,
seats, stage.
What happened was I'm on a... what used to be a fairly secretive email list called the Electronic Grimoire, which I think you're on as well.
Yeah.
And the EG was one of the very early magic email lists, and I joined 20 years ago.
What was that, 80s or something almost?
Late it was, 80s? No, it was early,
early 90s. 90s, yeah.
It was before the web, before the World Wide Web.
Yes.
But I joined, I think, about 20 years ago in 94. Anyway,
it was just a bulletin board back then, a BBS.
It was just a bulletin board, and then it became a listserv, which it is now. And the idea behind it was to archive all magical knowledge, so you can search all the posts going back for 25 years or whatever.
There were some great posts.
And there's some great posts, and a lot of famous people have been on and off it.
Yep.
Anyway, at any rate, one of the things that was posted on there was that David Sandy, who at the time was doing the seminar in Kansas City,
I know what you mean, just a minute.
The Session, I think it was called The Session or something. Anyway, he produces a lot of things. In fact, he produces... Tom Mullica's Red Skelton show in Branson. Mm-hmm. So he's a terrific producer and former IBM president. And David, and he's about 12, I think. So, you know, we all hate him. But anyway, so David posted a thing saying, hey, I've got a job in January. This is 2001. He says, I've got a job in January in D.C. I need local D.C. magicians. If we can, please let me know if you're interested. Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't, I was in the holiday mess. You know how busy it is around the holidays. I was doing so many shows and I didn't get around. I had to get around and go back and catch up on my old EGs. And I saw this, and this is like, January 8th or 9th. And I go and I send him an email and I hit send, and my hand to God, You can't write this stuff. You can't make this stuff up. The second that I hit the send button, my phone rings and David Sandy's on the phone. And I'm like, wow, you're good.
Have you got
Are you doing mentalism now? What is the deal? Well, it turns out what had happened was, and you remember that very nasty election of 2000 where there were all these lawsuits. We didn't actually have a winner until almost Thanksgiving, pushed the whole inaugural thing back. And in fact, a lot of the venues were already booked and everything.
That was the Hanging Chad issue back then in Florida, right?
It was not just Hanging Chad. Yeah, ironic. Yes, which was crazy, which ironically had been invented by the Democratic Party in Chicago to try to make sure that they're, you know, anyways. so more dead people could vote in Chicago. Yeah. And we know about this in Baltimore. Anyway, the point is that, he called me because he said, we have 21 magicians. And this backstory is interesting on this. Mike, back in September of the previous year of 2000, Michael Amar had been doing a party, doing close up at a homecoming at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, for one of the fraternities.
Mm-hmm.
And this really nice millionaire businessman approached him and said, "This is great. I love the magician. Listen, I'm going to be the head of the inaugural committee when Bush wins. We want to get magicians in. I want to talk to you about, let's get a bunch of magicians to do this at the cocktail parties and banquets that we do for the night before the inaugural." Now, what you have to understand is the inaugural is paid for with private money. It's not paid for by the taxpayers. And so the money has to be raised. Mm-hmm. And so there's a banquet the night before the inaugural, typically.
Okay.
And that banquet is a $10,000 a plate at the time. At the time, the inaugural cost $45 million.
I thought there were several different banquets. In other words, that there's
this
one
is,
inaugural.
No, that's the night after the night of the inaugural, the night after the inauguration, the day of the inauguration. There are a bunch of inaugural balls.
Which are separate
that
from
night.
The one you're talking
this
about.
This is the night before.
Okay.
He's
okay.
Still the president-elect. He hasn't been he hasn't been sworn in yet.
But he's already town,
He's already in town, hasn't been sworn in yet. So this is the night before, and this is a banquet that's hosted by the inaugural committee. And at the time, the cost of the inaugural was $45 million, and they raised $50 million. The banquet itself cost $5 million to put on.
Wow.
Okay. It's so basically you have 5,000 people at $10,000 a plate.
Yeah.
So probably the one of the most exclusive, one of the ritziest strolling gigs you can possibly imagine.
Yeah.
And people like Bill Gates and Steve Case are in the room. Okay. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was very funny because, one of the magicians, Patrick, oh my God, I'm forgetting his name now. I'm so sorry. One of the magicians, very famous guy, was doing the, pen through bill and he had the guy, he borrowed a dollar bill, had the guy sign it with a pen.
Mm-hmm.
And he said the whole line about you've just committed a felony and the whole table just fell out, cracked up. He said, and the guy said, "Son, you better save that bill because soon my signature is going to be on all of them." Turned out the guy was the Treasury Secretary designate. This only happened. You can't make this stuff up. It's too good.
Right.
It's only in D.C., right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, so we said, so David Sandy is calling me, right? And he says, "I need you because we had our 21 magicians or 24 magicians that we needed because they had three different venues because they had to break it up. There's no place in D.C. you could get 5,000 people in for a banquet." And so that they could secure anyway.
Right.
The Secret Service, you know, goes crazy on this stuff.
I can only imagine.
Yeah. Anyway, so it was a lot harder back then to actually get to the White House, apparently. Anyway, so they said we had a couple of people drop out. Well, it turns out that there's one very famous magician, I'm not going to mention the name, who did not pass the security background check. He had apparently chained himself to the fence in a nuclear reactor in the 70s or something. I don't know. But he had an FBI file.
Okay.
So they had some people drop out. And I know for a fact that another very famous close-up magician politely declined, basically saying
– didn't want to support Republicans?
He said, "I'm not going to work for that man. He stole the election."
Oh.
So you can guess who that might have been. Anyway, the point is – the point is, so they needed a couple people, and they'd spent all their travel budget. So they needed local guys, and they booked me, and I was the last guy they brought in. But in all fairness, I was on the list. But I was the last. I felt like kind of Harry Anderson in Night Court, you know? Yeah, I was way low on the list, but I was on the list.
Yeah.
So so I'm in there, and I'm like a kid in a candy store because I'm looking around, and I've got, you know, Glenn Falkenstein and Francis Willard. I've got
Michael Finney, Michael
John
Lamar.
Schreiock. Yeah. No, Michael Finney wasn't at this one.
Wasn't he? Okay.
Giovanni. Mm-hmm. You know, all these great names. You know, Michael Ammar. And it was funny because Michael Ammar had just finished writing the instructions for the Goshman 3D Bunnies. They just come out. Can you believe that? It was 20 years, or that was, 15 years ago.
15 years.
The 3D Bunnies came out, and there are 24 magicians, okay? Guess who was the only magician who had Sponge Bunnies with him for this event?
Could that have been you?
It was me. And I said to Michael brought a table so he could do cups and balls. I'm like, "Michael, did you bring the bunnies?" And he did the face palm. He was like, "Oh my God, I can't believe I didn't bring the bunnies." And I was nervous, so I'm going out in the hallway doing stuff. They had us in this green room for hours and hours, sitting around with the Navy band who had been sitting there all day. They sat there for 8 hours to play a 30-second fanfare. Because believe it or not, there's different music for the president-elect than for the actual president. They have a different
I guess they can only use Hail to the Chief when you become the chief.
It's actually the president. That's correct. The president or ex-president. Yeah. So anyway, so we did all this, and it was fun. We had a good time. And the Republicans don't have the best celebrities, though. I think it was hosted by Wayne Newton and Bo Derek. Okay. Or something, and we need to have the better celebrity. But anyway, so we had a good time with that, and that was great. We got pictures and everything like that, and I'm still using one of those pictures on my website. And we got a very nice thank you from the inaugural committee, which was just the best testimonial ever I've ever gotten in my life. Betsy said, take down your website, put that letter up with your phone number. That's all you need.
That's all you need, yeah.
And then 4 years later, Dick Steiner called me up and he said, listen, I really would like to get in on the next one. Let's make a deal with whichever one of us gets into it for the next one. Please, can we bring the other one in? And yeah. I said, sure, no problem. So 4 years later, 2005, Bush gets reelected. I get a call from Dick Steiner saying, you're not going to believe this, but the entertainment agency called me and I'm supposed to book all the magicians.
So David Sandy was out, but Dick Steiner was in.
Yeah, Dick Steiner was in. And so he booked all the magicians, brought me along in there. And I worked a different venue, and we had a blast with that. We had people like Tim Hall and Raj Madoc and Barry Taylor. And it was a lot of local magicians, Alain New and people like that. And so that was great. So that was my second inaugural, which is great because doing one is great. Doing two, I guess they figure, well, it must be pretty good if he did two of them. Yeah. And I ended up doing a third one. I skipped 2009, which I'm just as glad that I did because that was kind of a disaster. But in terms of the logistics of the inauguration, you may recall. And then I did this most recent one in 2013. I was brought in. Now, that was not at the pre-inaugural ball. That was actually the one that the American Legion does, the Salute to Heroes, where they have the Medal of Honor recipients. They invite all the living Medal of Honor recipients. And they had about 25 of them, and that was hosted by Tom Brokaw. And Vice President Biden showed up at that one, drunk. Very drunk, by the way.
So really, David Sandy, that was the first time they actually used a group of magicians for inauguration?
So far as I know, that was the first time, yeah. Okay. And
so now it's become a tradition almost.
Well, almost. It depends. Now, the only magician that I know of that worked an actual inaugural ball where the president was going to be at this last time was John Armstrong. Mm-hmm. And he was across the street from where we were. And traditionally, the president made an appearance for the Medal of Honor recipients. President Obama is the only president that has not done that. But all the others did. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so those are the inaugurals. And that was fun. And again, security was crazy. It was interesting because in 2001, this was pre-9/11. The security was actually like what you would get in the old days in an airport. There was a metal detector. And there's nothing funnier, by the way, than watching a bunch of magicians go through a Secret Service pat-down. This is incredibly amusing for everyone involved, particularly the Secret Service agents. Now I do presidential events almost annually. I did the last 3 years, I did the Christmas tree lighting. And so it was funny because in 2013, I did the inaugural. And the month earlier, I had done the Christmas tree lighting. So the agents all knew me already. Mm-hmm. And I actually, it was funny because, as you know, my costume is kind of a Victorian costume and I wear this long frock coat. Well, this was a hotel with a staff that had never dealt with presidential level security before. And the woman who was in charge of security for the hotel had a real problem with my long coat because they had a list of things that were not allowed. And overcoats had to be checked because you could obviously conceal a weapon. And so she said to me, she pulled me out of the line and said, I'm sorry, you're going to have to remove your coat. And I said, I'm sorry, I don't have to do that. She said, what do you mean? I said, this is my costume. This is what I wear. I've got pockets full of magic props. I need the coat. And she said, oh, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to ask you to do that. So I went to the Secret Service. The Secret Service agents all knew me. They walked over and said, what's the problem? And she said, well, he's got to take off his coat. And they just laughed. And they said to me, show her the picture. And so I pulled out my cell phone and showed a picture of me at the with the Obamas at their Halloween party in 2010 in the White House wearing exactly the same costume I was wearing standing in front of her with the coat.
Yeah.
And so the Secret Service guy said, we don't have a problem with the coat. And she said, okay. So I will tell you, by the way, because we do want to provide content for magicians, if you were ever working a high security event, particularly presidential level security, have all of your props in clear Ziploc bags, just like you're going through airport security. Have all your props in clear Ziploc bags, no knives or sharp weapons, no fire, okay? So no flash paper, So the flash paper and the knife through coat, not, and the bullet catch, not, not preferred tricks. If you need to open a deck of cards, do it before you get to the venue.
Yeah.
With, you know, use a knife.
So that way they can take a look at it.
Mm-hmm. Right. And cause they will take those away.
Well, there was a treasury building here in Houston, and I had performed there once for a group. And same thing, you know, that they had a metal detector and all this. Right. Now, this was something that did take a lot of time for everybody to go through. But because of my props, they had to go through all the stuff individually. Like you say, even the decks of cards had to be open, kind of go through to show that there's nothing in there but cards in that box.
You know, right.
Thing. But I like the idea with the Ziploc bag. Now, there was a funny thing because that I was then hired to do a return engagement for a different company. But apparently that they had contacted the Treasury to say, you know, here's who are the approved people who are going to be coming through, and one of them is a performer, a magician. Well, I got a call back from them saying that I couldn't perform because magicians are not on the list who are authorized and allowed to come in, you know, to the Treasury building here. And so I got this lady's phone number, contacted her, and they said, yeah, that on the national level for all Treasury buildings, there are certain things, that there are types of entertainment that we don't allow, but in particular, for an example, like rock bands or something, you know, we don't mind if there's going to be like a chamber music orchestra, or, you know,
right.
a quartet or something, or a harpist, you know, but, you know, people would like to have weddings here because it's a beautiful venue. However, that's not what we're about. And so there are certain types of events we will allow, some we don't. But in particular, I said, so, you know, why, what's wrong with the magician? They said, well, don't know. It's just, you know, on the list. And so, you know, at first she was very businesslike. And after a few minutes, you know, kind of talking, that she lightened up and then, you know, started to be a lot nicer, you know, to me. But basically, said,
sure.
You know, the rules are the rules, and that you can't come in. But so the time before, I guess I had just kind of slid in because they didn't tell them that I was going to be there. Until
well,
after
that's
I was
interesting there. Because, you know, at that point, sometimes it pays to try to find out who has the authority to change the rule, because somebody,
if you know the president, that helps.
Yeah, well, you know, but here's the thing. You know why they don't allow rock bands in those facilities?
Is it because of the sonic blast would mess up their audible detectors or something in security?
No, the noise level would cover somebody trying to drill into a safe. I'm quite
You've
serious.
Thought this through, haven't you?
I know one of the guy who used to be the guy who was in charge of training Secret Service officers in recognizing counterfeit money was a magician. Hmm. He used to come into Al's magic shop all the time, and he bought all the money tricks, even though technically they is illegal to deface a currency, but he'd buy all of them because the stuff he was teaching was so incredibly dry and boring that he had to liven it up somehow. So if he used a flash bill or, you know, a puzzle or some kind of a bill change or bill switch, that would wake people up and,
sure,
and get them interested in what he was doing. So, yeah, I learned some of this stuff. They don't want anything that's loud enough that could cover an explosion, any kind of a charge or gunfire or anything like that.
Hmm.
Yeah, and that's why they don't let the rock band in.
Yeah,
so it's, yeah, it's just, it's a weird thing. But the magicians, I imagine the reason is they assume magicians are skilled enough that they're going to try to steal something.
That's kind of what I thought too.
You know, which I think is really funny, but now that Congress has recognized magic as a performing art. Hello.
Yes.
You know about that, right?
Yes,
our
I do.
Friend,
yeah.
Our friend Dal Sanders.
Dal Sanders, you know, right.
You know,
past president of the SAM.
Past president of the SAM, has managed to do what, go where no man had gone before. And he's got that. And I have a copy of that document on my phone that I can show to people who are skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
Now that magic is a recognized performing art, I think it's time maybe to review some of those rules and see if we can't get.
Well, that's something also I think is worth for magicians who don't know that should get a copy of that to take with some of their promotional material or publicity material to the local newspaper, because a lot of newspapers in their arts section will not recognize magic as being a performing art. They kind of put it as one of the low arts. And so now having this designation, I would think that would elevate us to the point where that they would then post these announcements whenever there's
going
to be a show.
I've never had a problem with posting an announcement of a magic show in a paper. What it does do, which is very important, especially for performers who want to do some educational things, is it allows you to do to apply for grants from state and local arts councils. Because you've now got the federal, because nobody wants to be first in the pool. You know, the way you got to understand, we're business owners, we're entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
But bureaucrats have a different mentality. The entrepreneur's mentality is, let's get it done. Let's figure out a way to solve the problem and get to where we're trying to go. The bureaucrat's mentality is, I don't want to be blamed if things go wrong. So it's always damage control. What could possibly go wrong? And the way an entrepreneur and the way a bureaucrat gets ahead is by increasing their power and authority and their budget. Because it's not about accomplishment. It's about prestige and authority. And so once you understand that, it becomes much easier to work with bureaucracies. And anybody who works with schools, districts knows exactly what I'm talking about. It's a bureaucratic mentality. Mm-hmm. And there are some virtues to this. There are virtues of recognizing people and being detail oriented in a variety of things. But it can be very frustrating for people who are business owners and entrepreneurs, and especially creative types, to run into these some seeming brick walls of rules and regulations. And so, especially where I live in the People's Republic of Maryland, it's quite intense. So, it's very, very important to understand that mentality so that when you deal with these issues, and I do a lot of, things for government agencies all the time, and those have pretty much dried up now because of the GSA scandal of a couple of years ago where they had the big party in Vegas and they hired a magician. And so, a guy who's a very fine magic magician and speaker who for years has spoken at an event for the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, they're required by law to send out a request for proposals, but they, write the proposal so that basically he's the guy that can fulfill the requirements.
I know how RFPs work. Yeah.
And they book him every year. Mm-hmm. Well, but the word magician is in there and it leaked to the press. And the White House nixed it. The word came down from the big house saying, you got to cancel this. And so he's done this multi-year run. They can't hire him anymore. And it's really horrendous because it's interesting because I got calls from Politico. I got an interview in Politico over this. Which is probably on their website somewhere. And they said, you do a search on Politico on magician, you'll probably get it. And basically what I said was, The one group of people we need talking to government officials is magicians, because we're experts in deception and creative thinking. And who needs that more than government?
Right. Well, look at the war magician. This is something that, helped the war effort back in World War II when they had – my mind just went completely blank as to
Jasper Maskelyne, the seventh – mm-hmm. generation of the Maskelyne wizard families in England,
and had contributed significantly to camouflage and to the success of the war effort.
He actually hid an entire city. He completely camouflaged the port of Alexandria.
Yeah, moved it essentially.
So the Nazis bombed the wrong place. Yeah. Oh yeah. He also created an entire ghost division of tanks made out of spray painted cardboard up in near Calais, so to draw Nazi units away from the actual landing site in Normandy. Yeah, they did a big. Now the book is a bit overblown. The book, The War Magician, kind of overstates it a little bit, but it is. But Jasper's contribution was significant.
I understand also, though, that there were some things that have not yet been released. They were supposed to wait, like, I don't know, 7,500 years or something until after the war before that they would actually give the full story.
Well, that would be very interesting. If all that stuff gets released, somebody's going to make a – in fact, Tom Cruise was attached to a movie attempt, but that kind of fell by the wayside. Somebody was also going to do a movie, I think, with Michael Douglas and Catherine Zeta-Jones about Robert Houdin's trip, going to Algeria to stop that war. But we digress. So the history of magic and politics goes back a long time. And, of course, you can see various political cartoons showing politicians, deceiving the public and, depictions of magicians doing the shell game or the cups and balls or the three card.
It took the longest time, of course, for us to get Houdini on the stamp. I remember years ago when we were trying to get this stamp struck, and they had used, the SAM in particular had used every contact that they had, when Clark, Cary Grant was on the board of directors at the Academy of Magical Arts, used influence, et cetera. And so I have good friends with George W. Bush, and that I said, well, look, I think I can get a letter to his dad, who at the time was president, And so the SAM had given me enough information. So I went across the street. I lived in Midland, Texas, and gave it to George. And he said, yeah, I make sure Dad gets it. And it was kind of funny because he wrote a letter back to me from the sitting president and saying that, unfortunately, this is not something that's within my purview. It's the Postmaster General. But if I was going to make a suggestion as to what the stamp would look like, it would look like this. And he drew a picture like of a box and then squiggly lines around it, you know, with nothing inside. And he said, he's gone. You know.
That's great. Well, you know, I don't know if you know this, but George H.W. Bush, the 41st president, was a magician. Is a magician. He does magic tricks. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
He used to come into Al's magic shop and buy tricks, and he would do things for friends and family and stuff. So he's a little bit of not super serious about it, but he enjoyed doing the occasional magic trick.
George never told me that. Interesting.
So, which is kind of interesting. Yeah. So also, and a lot of different politicians. There was there's one senator I remember from Colorado, I believe, a conservative, used to buy flash bills and ignite them on the floor of the Senate so as to illustrate government wasting money. Mm-hmm. But there's been a rich history of magic in Washington, D.C. You know, Senor Blitz was President Lincoln's favorite magician, and Lincoln may have been one of the first, if not the first president, to actually have a command performance by a magician in the White House.
I'm sure you've done a lot of research on that, being out in that area and talking with politicians.
A little bit. I mean, you know, and again, it's so funny. I guess probably one of my favorite gigs that I ever did, which was a lot of fun, was I did a reception, opening night reception for the National Association of Lieutenant Governors. And this was a fun thing because at the time, nobody cared about lieutenant governors. Nobody, you know, who cares? You know, there's no press, no media. And it was just this little tiny hotel, not too far from the White House. And I show up, and of course, some of my magic has a little political thing. I do one of my signature routines is a one coin flurry that ends with a jumbo coin. Mm-hmm. And I talk about, you know, I produce a coin and people act, you know, hopefully register surprise. And I say, well, don't be surprised. I'm from Washington, D.C. People do this all the time. They're called congressmen. She gets a laugh. Mm-hmm. I say, well, don't laugh at your money. Another laugh. And then, and I say, you know, but you can tell I'm, you know, magicians and politicians, that's who can pull money out of the air. You can tell which one I am because I'm not running from anything. And it goes on from there. Well, this played great with the lieutenant governors. But it was really funny because that afternoon was the day that Eliot Spitzer resigned as governor of New York because of this whole prostitution scandal.
Yes.
The guy who had been the former U.S. attorney, by the way, and prosecuted these things, was now the thing, had now resigned. And so his lieutenant governor suddenly his lieutenant governor was supposed to be the keynote speaker that night or the next day. And he had to send his regrets saying, sorry, I'm busy getting sworn in and being governor. So now, all of a sudden, the press descends. Because now, the only thing the press can talk about is, what's a lieutenant governor and how can I get one on camera? Find out because every state has different rules about lieutenant governors. And in, for example, in Texas, the governor of Texas does not very little. The governor of Texas does mostly ribbon cuttings and baby kissing and handshakes. And the lieutenant governor actually runs, the lieutenant governor in Texas actually runs the government and is the liaison with the legislature. In other states, the governor almost has dictatorial powers, like in Maryland and Illinois and places like that. In fact, funny thing was that the first lieutenant governor I met in the men's room of all things, was the guy, the lieutenant governor of Illinois, who a few months later became governor when his governor got sent to jail.
In Texas or where?
In Illinois.
Oh, in Illinois, sorry.
That was the guy who I can't pronounce.
Blagojevich.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. That guy. So, isn't that funny? So, yeah. So you know, you just never know what's going to happen. So, but by that time, the press knew about lieutenant governors. So it becomes a civic. And the thing that's nice about these political things, although we don't like the scandals too much, is it does become kind of a civics lesson. It's like, you know, do you really know how your state government is run? Do you really know how your federal government works? And so that can be pretty helpful too. Yeah. But my goodness, I was kind of hoping to do some things that would be helpful. But if you want more stories, I got one more story, which is of course the my presidential performance, which is when I performed in the White House for the Obamas and the first family and 300 of their closest friends. This was an interesting story, and I think there are some lessons here actually for magicians.
I hate to leave you hanging, but our time for this episode is up, and the story that Eric is about to tell you has so many interesting side roads that it would take a long time to get to the end. I know you will want to listen to the second and final part of this podcast, where Eric talks about his experience of performing for President Obama in the White House. If you have not already joined our Facebook page, then please get in on the engaging discussions at facebook.com/TheMagicWordPodcast. You can join us there and discuss your favorite episode or suggest a topic or a performer that you would like to hear on an upcoming podcast. Of course, you can always drop me an email to scott@TheMagicWordPodcast.com if you have any suggestions or input. And if you enjoy The Magic Word, then I would really appreciate you leaving a 5-star rating and some glowing comment in the iTunes store. If you don't like The Magic Word, then please drop me a line personally and tell me how you think it can be improved. I give every comment my undivided attention and personal reply. And as always, this is about you, not me. So thanks for your support, and thanks for listening. Scotty out.